and K219KU, Nahalem, serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 on your FM dial. Streaming live and archived, baby, at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
This is Angle of View. Hoy es Cinco de Mayo de 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Angle of View Classics Week 3, Crime and Criminals. Let's be bad. A History of Violence, 2005, directed by David Cronenberg. Review date, November 20th, 2025. Third viewing. Existential horror hatched inside family drama, where it can do the most damage. The title is a brilliant frame for the story in that it's not just one man's flight from his past and the delusion that he can put it away forever, but also the story of violence as a monstrous and universal male inheritance, and the story of violence as the spine of all mythic heroism, and the story of how America was built, the carnage atop which all the peaceful small towns of the heartland, full of all those nice people, grew and thrived. It's full of big gestures that I assume are inherited from the graphic novel, like the 5 dozen different kinds of foreshadowing in the first act. But these are all forgiven because they don't come close to cheapening the drama here, which is nothing short of extraordinary and devastating from one scene to the next, even when it's funny, and which climbs a steep ramp, peaking with the unbelievable moment when Edie's fake crying turns into real crying, or is revealed as having always been real crying, and her stranger husband chases her into the staircase. When has a comparison of two sex scenes ever offered up more character insight or curdled a theme harder? The atmospheric pressure and emotional murk of that second one is almost unbearable, and the courage with which Viggo Mortensen and Maria Bello commit to it is astonishing. They climb all the way down into the pit. Cronenberg does right to lower this ugly subject to the eye level of each character and stay with them down there. As their belief in the self dissolves, anger emerges in their bodies, linking together all the bloody scenes and the second sex scene and the 3 amazing scenes of Tom/Joey and his son with a terrible low significance. There is piercing earnestness in Edie and Jack confronting this stranger in their house. It breaks your heart to see their anguish pressed up against his flailing inability to receive them, caught between 2 equally impossible lies. It turns out, "I'm not that person anymore" isn't much more of a reach than "I never was." For their part, his family, the people now filled with horror at Tom/Joey's violent ways, won't soon forget that a few days earlier they had joined the rest of the town in celebrating him for those exact same qualities. And when he finally breaks off from his second family to go reckon with his first, his brother greets him with the same sentiment. Admiration for his gun has turned to horror, and he is now fixed in disappointment at who this person always was. Does he deserve it? Did he deserve the chance at a second life that he took for himself? Was he right to take it? How much truth has there been in anything he has told his wife and kids? How much truth was there in the psycho loose cannon part he played when he was a youth trying to impress his big brother and the power standing behind him? Who is in there? The pain of this confusion is overwhelming and omnidirectional by this point in the movie, and it keeps thickening until the final scene seals you in hell. The hell of never being able to know the people closest to you. The hell of never being able to say who you are and who you are not. In the Line of Fire, 1993, directed by Wolfgang Petersen. Review date, April 7th, 2024, probably something like 8th viewing. This seems to have wanted to be the highest stakes cat-and-mouse thriller ever conceived, and to have chosen assassination of the president as its stakes for that reason, but to have also wanted not to have any politics in it. The prevailing feeling among comfortable America at this time was that people were sick of politics and deserved a break from political content in our entertainment as a reward for having prevailed over communism. Unfortunately, call it a symptom of imperial decadence, the demand for cracking entertainment was higher than ever, so the federal government was still used frequently as a stage and symbol of a general kind of importance in a thriller. The way this movie tried to reconcile the centrality of the U.S. president in the story with an apolitical tone was to make the president in question a vacuous suit belonging to no party in particular and given no speech that rises above white noise, and to make the aspiring assassin someone who hates America not for its policies or its attitudes, for that is a hatred with which the audience could find common cause, but for a rare and deeply personal reason, because he was psychologically warped by, Checks notes, his having been trained to kill for the CIA. Whew, good thing you thought of that, screenwriter Jeff McGuire. Otherwise, you might have stepped in some politics. Seriously, though, outwardly it means to be purely a story of duty. How much of duty is just the principle of doing something well, and how much cuts closer to the heart of a person. And as such, it's mostly not bad. There is more interiority attempted here than a typical movie of this caliber would gesture toward, and it constitutes the screenplay's high points. The trouble is with nearly everything else. The screamingly obvious redemption arc, the totally undistinguished romantic subplot, young partner trope, stymieing pencil pushers trope, and the hero and villain are really the same trope. Not to mention the dopey, almost self-parodic director's tricks that Peterson pulls out, like the whirling shot around our hero as his senses are overwhelmed in his effort to scan through the camera flashes for a gunman while sick with the flu. And the fact that Clint Eastwood can't pull off a haunted man desperate for redemption any more than he can pull off a man who plays the piano. Such soulful things are just not him. Interiority cannot shine out from an actor with no insides. But there is, of course, one other asset, John Malkovich, who gets most of the best lines and keeps his character scary even as he gets into more and more laughable disguises, which is his character's cliche. I kept thinking of Tim Heidecker or Eric Andre when a new one turned up. Odd Man Out, 1947, directed by Carol Reed. Review date, July 26, 2023. First viewing. Riveting filmmaking, perched between thriller and drama in a gorgeously measured way that draws out the best from each. The emotionalization of the potboiler. Carol Reed arguably walked this line for a lot of his career, and arguably better than any other director in the English language, and this is as good as it got. A moment of expressive discovery for noir style, pushing past the basically lurid and into the realm of the Italian Baroque. James Mason is the picture of agony. Few other performances as an injured character have transferred the bodily pain to the viewer so effectively. You never for a second stop thinking about his broken arm and festering gunshot wound, how he has both, and you feel the worsening minute by minute. The onset of the fever, the episode he spends shivering in the rain, how much it hurts to run, how much it hurts to take off his jacket. His quiet and stillness are wrenching, the way he uses the tiny crushed breaths he is able to summon to ask whether he killed the man he'd struggled with and shot on the steps, never mind whether it's out of guilt or fear of his pursuit. The effect of his crying out in the snug at the pub, and of his Mad King speech that follows in Shell and Lukey's apartment, is all the more magnificent after you have seen him reduced by so much. In keeping with the topic of Carol Reed and his mastery of human feeling, every character is given their dignity, even the scoundrels and the rats. You feel empathy even despite yourself, as for Teresa when she betrays Nolan and Murphy and then lies to witnesses about her involvement. Rosie, the grandmother putting up the escaped convict Johnny, is given an ocean of sadness to swim in. Decades of piled up pain that can't help but pour out when family conflicts tighten, as they do with Kathleen. And oh, Kathleen. Her awareness at the stupidity of her love for Johnny, a tale which culminates in her doing the stupidest thing ever. The emptiness of her little life that drove her to him. The meagerness not just of Shell's morals, but even of his venality. The narcissistic rage of Lukey, the bruised pride of Tober hiding behind his scientist's mask. It's all there, all this beaten, quivering humanity. Everything in Odd Man Out extends in all directions. Every character's life, no matter how small on the screen, spills off it and continues frictionlessly in your imagination. R.C. Sheriff's script provided the most wonderful amount of space between the lines, but only Carol Reed, with his amazing mix of spirit and control, could have found such painful poetry in those spaces. Thelma and Louise, 1991, directed by Ridley Scott. Review date, August 18th, 2023. Probably something like 10th viewing. Some of these movies from the early 90s I watched a lot as a kid. It wins on the sheer emotional force of its best scenes, all of which have that terrible heat and pressure that the dialogue is too sparse to relieve, as in a good short story. The tormented morality of Louise's fatal action, that it both was and was not justified, is teased out not just by the panic and terror that it induces in the protagonist, but by the way the waitress is able to make a joke out of it to the cops later. Thelma suggesting they simply tell the cops what happened, and Louise saying, "Which part?" Louise putting her hand over Jimmy's eyes and asking what color hers are. Hal giving JD a working over with his hat. Thelma remembering in a fit of worked-up drunken laughter what a dumb look the guy had on his face when they shot him. Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon and director Scott and screenwriter Callie Corey are all completely inside these scenes and on fire together. And far more than the lovely postcard photography of the American West, it is the crumpled human feeling of those scenes that keeps you watching. The message's feminism is rather squished and stumpy when viewed from a distance, unfortunately. Now this, at long last, is liberation. And it's an especial shame the way the payoff scene with the truck driver drags this message to the surface and slaps a pair of clown shoes on it. It means to be a big release moment, but it's the falsest note in the movie. Also, the twang-a-lang needle drops are awful and profuse, and simply cannot live side by side with the washy incidental score that Hans Zimmer composed. And as to the ending, the manipulative aspect isn't the character's choice itself, nor the fade to white, but the comic highlight reel that begins to run half a second later as the closing credits start up. Remember when they were alive? Still, despite these foibles of the Hollywood drama, Thelma and Louise is a taut and fierce picture that continually pulls you through it on the strength of its lead characters and the vertiginous ladder of good, hard scenes that it runs them down. You come to understand viscerally that their trials have forced them to experience anguish and exhilaration as two sides of the same coin. And in this way, though the theme gets a little warped in the hot furnace of the scenes that shape it, it makes the burden of womanhood something you feel rather than ponder. So stifling and sad is the space that they inhabit even before their nightmare begins in earnest that it just kills you to watch the remaining air get choked out of their possibilities. Thief, 1981, directed by Michael Mann. Review date July 16th, 2025. Third viewing. The criminal economy is still capitalism. The shadow retains the contours of the object, and nobody sets the terms except the boss. Frank's moderate wealth gets him 0% closer to autonomy, and he emerges from his jobs looking like he's been in a coal mine. Every surface he touches is wet black or neon. His surroundings doom him from the start, so his only option for radical action, when it's become clear his entire life is at risk of being destroyed, is to destroy it himself first. Great ugly material here, brought to life by a famously tough director who already had firm bearings. A little pat or over-emphatic at times, but as solid as lead almost everywhere, even if it is primarily a creature of mood. The mood is lead. James Caan is exceptional and can find a lot of nuance in a character whose outward range of expression is narrow. Prison will do that to you. His scenes with Tuesday Weld in the diner and with Willie Nelson on the prison phone are both unforgettable, even if both relationships in the film work a lot better at the scene level and seem flimsier when you zoom out and hunt for larger shapes. Besides this, I have only two real gripes. The first is the idea that Frank, with his experience and hard-won circumspection, would be naive enough to get himself neck-deep in a situation like this. Even with circumstances conspiring to give everything the kind of urgency that can cloud a person's reason, I struggle to imagine him ever entertaining the idea that he could get the outcome he wanted out of a guy like Leo, or that he would so flatly refuse to pay off the cops and think he could get away with it. Wouldn't he be especially eager, given his previous prison term, to do whatever he needed to do to avoid another? Leo lectures him for rejecting the basic terms of criminal life that make it sustainable, and though he's a monster, he's completely in the right on this point. Frank's opposing point of view is not only unexplored, but unimaginable. The movie is mood-first and is wonderful on that level, unromantically romantic, but the story it installed to support this mood was too schematic. My second gripe is that what Tangerine Dream, almost certainly at man's instruction, whipped up for the climax is a weak tea ripoff of Comfortably Numb, which is a song I don't even like at full strength. Inside Man, 2006, directed by Spike Lee. Review date September 30th, 2025. First viewing. The somewhat frosty reception this got at the time, especially from Spike Lee fans, left me unprepared for how good it is. The plot premise is clever, the theme sticks to you, going for real moral ick without any of the usual crime fiction prurience, and the pacing keeps enough narrative balls in the air at any one time that you never feel as though you can put together the schematic for the whole thing in your head, and thus never stop being on alert. Even 20 years ago, screenplays were significantly less stupid. Yes, this was one of Lee's first conventional hired gun assignments, but come on, he throws himself right into it, directing with great kinetic force, finding the heat in every scene without ever sacrificing control. And yes, I also love his personal films, the ones nobody else in the world could make, and I'm glad he didn't send his whole career in this direction, but the job he does here proves that he could have if he'd wanted to. Not all directors who typically write their own scripts can pick up a genre bullet like this and chamber it properly. Denzel is utterly commanding, as always. Clive Owen is scary, if a bit self-conscious. He seems to be doing a version of the calm psychopath learned primarily from other movies. Though in a funny way, once you've gotten to the end, you realize that this makes perfect sense. And Jodie Foster is a bit bland in her character's smugness. She can do cunning, as Clarice Starling was, but she can't really do unctuous, and she falls back on a tight little smile that gets old quick. It's the supporting players, the ones in one or two scenes, who give the movie most of its glitter. There are perhaps 30 players who pop in and out like this, and they're all memorable. A large cast of bit players is not only vital to a story of a bank holdup during peak hours, but in the hands of Lee and this casting director, it's a demonstration of the glorious diversity of New York City humanity that the movie offers up without ever asking for applause for doing it. Blood Simple, 1984, directed by Joel Cohen. Review date March 21st, 2024, probably fifth viewing. Among the grisliest of the 80s neo-noirs, and one hell of a debut for the Coens, pulpy and cynical and philosophical and funny, in all the key ways that the rest of their career would be spent stitching together even more tightly. The great innovation in the story is, of course, the doings of the private detective, the everlastingly brilliant M. Emmett Walsh, of whom the spectacle of that evil little rat-like voice squeaking out of his big broad body never ceased to captivate, being unknown to all but one character, who himself ends up dead, so that nobody remaining has any idea who's been up to what. This is simply a great idea, and the movie coasts on it for a good long while. Depending on your perspective, it is either a little bothersome or brilliantly true to life that so many of the plot's steps depend on someone forgetting one little thing. Given how often I can get 2 miles from my home on a good day before realizing I left my prescription medication behind, I think it's entirely believable that people under a kind of stress that I, thank God, have never known in my life would slip up here and there. What I do find bothersome, though, is the way Ray withholds critical information from Abby for reasons that seem not to extend past the rigid requirements of his handsome, laconic Texas guy persona. Of course, you figure it's to protect her, but it gets to the point where his chances of successfully protecting her increase if he just tells her the whole story, and he still won't. And the little nuggets he does drop are not in character, but cooked up to intensify the atmosphere of fear and craziness. The clearest example being, he was alive when I buried him. Style easily carries the movie over these ruts, though. The world on display is so vile and scary. Is that incinerator just going, raging at all times? That your lurid side perks up quick and never stops rubbing its hands together. It ends up a slasher, for God's sake, and Frances McDormand a final girl. And it's a big, ugly good time. Charlie Varick, 1973, directed by Don Siegel. Review date October 3rd, 2025, first viewing. If your favorite stuff in crime fiction is the elaborate schemes that a smart criminal will cook up to get out of a jam, this is the one for you. It's about as fun and snappy on the plot level as any piece of bank robber pulp you're likely to encounter anywhere, but what makes it so interesting is the patient, pragmatic, workmanlike spirit in which the main characters are operating. They're creating all these crazy sparks all the time, but they're never sticking around to watch them fly. Walter Matthau takes an attitude towards his intensifying terrible circumstances so relaxed as to be worth laughing about in almost every scene. No matter how thin the ice under him gets, he'll be okay as long as he has enough gum. He trusts himself to think of the next move because he always does. His opposite number here is Joe Don Baker, a psycho son of a bitch mob enforcer who is equally methodical and contented, even when he's beating people to death. Despite carrying a tenth of the latter's darkness, you may wonder at times whether Cormac McCarthy might have been drawing upon this movie or its source novel when he wrote No Country for Old Men. Apart from the lazy and depressing use of racism for coloring, and the totally insupportable scenes in which one of these men takes a woman to bed, they get one each, and in neither case does it make a lick of sense that the woman would go for it, everything in the movie is good and exciting, and in particular, every morsel of conniving and violence that these men visit on each other is straight gangbusters. You are required to swallow some doozies in the initial setup, e.g., that Matthau's two areas of expertise are explosives and stunt pilotry, and that the whole criminal gang goes to the same dentist. But the script touches lightly enough on these things as not to come off insecure about them. Plus, the ever-reliable Don Siegel's direction is so punchy and hot-blooded that you will already be up to your elbows in it before you start noticing how silly these details are. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. Soy Will Hatman, y seguiré mirando si ustedes miran.
talk and civics during the day, arts and music in the evenings and on the weekends. We call it the Mullet Model, and since 2014, volunteers at X-Ray have been working to put a microphone to the best and most distinctive of Portland, and to make media more open and inclusive for all. Thank you to all the volunteers and members that support the station. Find out more by visiting us on the web at www.xray.fm.
Welcome to Back Fence Unhinged, a conversational full-body massage followed by in-and-out privileges to the sauna, only in storytelling form, to leisurely enjoy along with the middle of your day, afternoon, or night. You're about to hear an unhinged story about the importance of strong hips from the fifth strongest woman in the world, Gabby Dixon. Then comes the second unhinged part. We'll ask some questions about Gabby's story and perhaps share a story or two of our own based on what we hear. Who are we?
Well, I'm Frayne and you're Andrew.
I am.
Am I right?
Yes,
okay.
Yeah,
well, it's good to see you again.
Nice to see you as well.
Yeah.
Are you a bench presser?
Am I a bench presser? Yeah, I have. And I really don't want to say how much in front of Gabby that I can bench press, but... my main thing is I have very strong legs.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah. So, like,
what's your preferred weightlifting move then?
I love doing like deep squats.
Okay.
Deep squats with weights makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And I just notable is that I was one of the few 8-year-olds that could swim butterfly. Because of my leg strength, I could fly out of the water, and it was kind of awesome.
That's the hard one.
That is the hard
one.
That's
the hard stroke.
Yeah, it's what I swam swim team, breaststroke and butterfly. What about you, Andrew?
I, on occasion, will pick up a couple of 10-pound weights while I'm watching TV.
I don't feel bad anymore.
I walk a lot.
Yeah, as do I.
That sort of seems like I'm pretty good at Googling things.
Yes, good. Yeah. I started doing something called Japanese walking. Have you heard of this?
No.
Have you heard of Japanese walking?
Is it the one where you like flail your arms a lot and like make sure you do all the...
No. Well, I mean, maybe.
Okay.
That could be part of it. I feel like that could be part of it. It's where you walk leisurely for 3 minutes and then you walk as hard as you can and you do move your arms a lot for 3 minutes and you try to walk as fast as possible.
Okay.
And it's supposed to be really good for your lungs and your cardiovascular.
Not that I run, but I hear that's the way you should run.
It's like interval training.
A form of interval training. It's a form of HIIT, if we want to use the acronym. By way of introduction, let's talk a little bit more about Gabby Dixon,
yes.
Who is, in fact, not only the fifth strongest woman in the world, but the 3-time fifth strongest woman in the world.
World's most consistent.
Yes. Consistently 5. It's a good one. Multi-grip world record holder, nonprofit founder, strength coach, and model. That's a great, I love that menagerie of things that you are. She loves to inspire people of all colors, shapes, and sizes to try new things, be strong, and go for what they want in life.
That. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew.
You have such a unique story. How did you get into becoming one of the strongest people in the world?
Oh man, okay. I have always been strong. I've always been an athlete. My parents were both athletes growing up. They met in college, so they were, dad was football, mom was volleyball, so they knew we were going to be athletic kids. I did track and field, had a scholarship, did a bunch of other sports too, but then souped my way into almost making it to the Olympic trials, missed the Olympic trials, went and played rugby for a couple of years, played abroad, discovered strongman, came back. This is a really short, hard, fast version.
Yeah, this is fast.
A lot of stuff happened in between, but yeah, I'm here now and I've always been really, really strong. That's been a big part of like my athletic journey. And when it came down to powerlifting and strongman, I was like, this is where I think I can thrive. And I've just been pushing it ever since. So much so to where now I'm the fifth strongest woman in the world for 3 years. And I found out that I did all that with really bad hip dysplasia that I had no idea about until about 2 years ago.
Oh my God.
Wow. That is Wow, that's how strong you are, that you didn't even discover it until recently. You're just like, I might have a thing, but my body is still strong.
We're fine. Everything's fine.
We're fine. Yeah. How did you, I'm curious, because you, when you were running through your things, how did you discover the world's strongest? How did you discover that whole contest?
So I was in New Zealand playing rugby. I was playing, trying to go to do like international rugby. I was going to try to be in Team USA one day. So I was training there, and a girlfriend of mine who was just going to the gym regularly, she's like, I just started going to a strongman